Okay, welcome to this presentation, Advanced SIM Card Topics. Some of them are listed in the headline. Topics that I'm going to talk about is administrative commands for SIM cards, the iSIM application, the 5G-related dedicated file, this RRM applet and its use in Android carrier privileges, then a bit about global platform and some updates on PySIM Shell. The chapter about OTA was not finished in time, I have to admit. We can start to talk a bit about OTA, but I will not be able to cover the full breadth of the over-the-air topic in this talk, unfortunately. Nevertheless, I think it's going to be a lot of material anyway. So, yeah. If you have questions, I'm also looking at the chat. So if you want to comment or raise your hand, hopefully I will notice that. Just let me know if there's any questions or concerns or something is wrong. That, of course, can also be the case. So some very basic recap before we go into the detailed topics, some of the acronyms, some of the concepts. So smart large part about the SIM cards and related subscriber cards in 3GPP networks is about the file system of cards. We have the MF, the master file, which is the root directory. We have DFs, so-called dedicated files, which normal people would call subdirectories or folders. Then we have ADFs, application dedicated files, which is basically the root directory of an application. So in multi-application smart cards, there can be multiple applications, and each of these applications can have an application dedicated file, which then can contain more DFs, EFs, and so on. And which brings us to the EFs, the entry file or elementary file. I've seen several definitions for that acronym. Which comes in multiple flavors. What most people are familiar with is the transparent EF and the linear fixed EF. So the transparent EF is unstructured and just contains bytes, basically like a file on a Unix file system, which is just a stream of bytes. There's no structure to it. And there's also the concept of linear fixed files, which is a file consisting of fixed length records. Also the notion of cyclic files, and now also BRTLV files, which is something we will cover in more detail later in this presentation. So if we look at SIM cards, there are some bits that are specified by various standardization organizations. That should be ISO, not ISU, there in the top line. So ISO, ETSI, 3GPP specs mainly specify most parts of within those specification bodies. Most of the specs are released. There's also a global platform related to Java cards, which we will talk about a bit later. What's important to know is that those parts that are specified are really only those that are relevant after the card has been issued, which means once the card is placed in the phone and whatever you need from that point in the life cycle of a SIM card onwards, that's the part that is specified, because that's the part that needs to be interoperable. I mean, how does the phone read or write to the card? How do you perform over-the-air updates? How does authentication work? All of this is relevant. But whatever happens before that point in time in terms of the actual personalization and provisioning of cards is beyond the specification. And even, for example, how the secret key material for the authentication of the 3GPP network, how this material is stored or how it is inserted into the card, all of this is not specified for SIM cards, because it's not something that normally happens after the card has been deployed. At least that's not how it's foreseen by the standards bodies. If you're interested in this sort of smart card provisioning, production, personalization process, there was a talk in the Osmo DevCall series some months ago. You can check it out on our website and watch the video in case you're interested in that topic. So all of the stuff that we are talking about today is part of the specified, standardized part of the SIM card universe. But things that go beyond the normal read file, read binary, update file, authenticate, and verify PIN commands that are like the most basic operation that happens all the time. So one of these topics is the topic of the so-called administrative commands from ETCTS 102.222, which are different from the normal commands in that they are meant for the operator and card issuer. The normal commands that we see, like selecting a file, reading a file, updating a file, verifying a PIN, authentication, and so on, these are all things that the normal user, or let's say the phone of the user or the modem of the user, performs towards the smart card. And then there are additional administrative commands which are intended for use by the operator or the card issuer, how it is called sometimes in the specs. Those administrative commands typically only work after you have authenticated yourself against the card in some special way, so that the card knows you are basically the card issuer and you are privileged to perform these kind of commands. So what kind of commands do we have in these administrative commands? There, first and foremost, there is, of course, create file. And create file is sort of also how, in many smart card operating systems, at least, files are created when you create a smart card profile. So you create the MF, you create all the DFs, you create the EFs, you create the ADFs, and so on, all of those files. But at least in some cards, depending on the operating system support and depending on how the card is, the card profile looks like, it is possible to also create files at a later point in the life cycle, meaning that, for example, whenever 3GPP updates the specifications and introduces new files, such as the files for 5G that we are also going to talk about in a couple of slides, that once such new files are specified, an operator could remotely create such new new files on the card, even over the air, while the card is out there in the field, and thereby sort of adding a new functionality to the card that hasn't been there initially. There's a question about the terminate and delete, and I will get to that quickly. Let's go through the list. I mean, delete file is obvious. We delete it. There's nothing left after delete of the file. We could recreate it afterwards. Then we have the two deactivate and activate file commands. Those are for temporary deactivation, meaning the file content is retained. You just cannot select the file anymore once it's deactivated, and then later on the operator could again activate the file and thereby make it usable again. So that's basically just a temporary or possibly temporary thing. Then the termination are a permanent termination. That means after you have terminated the DF, it can never be used again. And that also means it still exists, but it's terminated in a certain life cycle state. And you cannot recreate it, for example, because there's still a terminated file with the same name. Whereas if you would delete it, then you could recreate a file with the same name because there's no file left at that point. Once again, keep in mind all of these commands, like the support for these commands is entirely optional, so it's highly dependent on your card operating system whether those commands are supported or not. In the Sysmo iSIM SJA2, all of those commands are supported, but not in all the profiles that we ship. They are permitted in all the different directories or applications, but the operating system is capable of those. Last but not least, there is terminate card usage, which permanently bricks the card. So don't do that unless you know what you're doing. Otherwise, you have produced a piece of electronic waste that you can dispose afterwards. And as Prom points out, this is meant for life cycles management, which is something that comes from the like smart card industry. Everything is about life cycles, life cycle of the card, life cycle of applications, life cycle of files. And once something is terminated, it is you cannot use it anymore in any way. Yeah, so these administrative commands, we get to PySim and I'll show a bit, but that's something also that was added to PySim shell a couple of months ago. So we have full support for those commands, so we can now deactivate, activate, create, delete files, depending on the permissions of course, that the card allows us to do as the operator. Okay. Sort of next topic in the list of topics I'd like to talk about is the iSIM application. So if we look a bit at the history, we have the initial 2G SIM cards, the first specified within, well, first CEPT and then ETSI, had two directories, two dedicated files, DFGSM and DFTelecom, where GSM contained the GSM-specific parameters, like the IMSI, for example, and DFTelecom contained the more general telecom-related parts, such as the phone book of the subscriber in those days where it was relevant to store this on the SIM card. Later on, before 3G networks were specified, ETSI specified the UICC, the Universal Integrated Chip Card, I guess it is, which is specified as an application-independent card, and the UICC has since been used in many different applications. One of them, or the primary one probably, was the USIM, the UMTS SIM application, which was specified in the context of the 3G network, UMTS network specification. When 4G came around, LTE, they reused the same USIM. So there was no new application specified for the use with 4G networks. They just added a couple of optional new files in the USIM related to evolved packet core usage. And then there was when IMS, specifically in the context of Volte and voice over Wi-Fi was specified, an iSIM application has been specified. So for IMS, there's an optional additional application that can be present on the UICC in parallel to the USIM application and in parallel to other applications and also in parallel to the old GSM and so on functionalities on the card. This is entirely optional. You can use, and I would expect, I mean, I don't really have that overview worldwide in the industry, but my feeling is that 90% or more networks that have IMS don't use iSIMs. So it's actually the more standard case is that there's no iSIM on the SIM card, no iSIM application, but still IMS networks are used. So there is no need for it because there's some fallback mechanisms specified how the relevant identities and addresses can be derived from the IMSI and from other properties which old USIM cards without an iSIM application contain. It's just that, like, if you want to deviate from those fallback and auto-generated identities, then you would need an iSIM to specify that. Or if you need some additional configuration that is not compatible with the fallback mechanisms, then you need the iSIM application to specify that. There are a couple of files which can be present either in the USIM application or in the iSIM application. That's quite strange. I don't know why exactly they did it that way, if it's just a historical artifact or if it's if there were so many users who wanted to stay with the USIM but still have some IMS-related bits configured without having an iSIM application deployed, I don't know. But there's a couple of files. They're listed here, those five files. They can exist either in the USIM or in the iSIM. And if you have an iSIM on the card, they must not exist in the USIM. The specifications are rather clear on that. So I'm just mentioning this so people don't make that kind of mistake. So either you have an iSIM application and then those files may exist in the iSIM, but not in the USIM, or you don't have an iSIM application and then they may exist in the USIM. Another topic related to iSIM application is the authentication context or security context. While the authentication mechanism, the UMTS aka, is exactly the same for iSIM and USIM, the context of both can be different. What do I mean by that? Basically, the transport and access layer network authenticates against the USIM application on the card. While if there is an ISIM on the card, then the IMS level authentication with the PCSCF, for example, is done against the ISIM application on the card. So at least in theory, and you can do that also with the SISMO ISIM cards, you can actually have even different key material and different algorithms configured for those two cases. There's no requirement that the key material and everything needs to be identical. It could be completely separate. It's just if you don't have an ISIM, then of course there's the fallback and the USIM key material and so on is used you don't have this choice anymore to have different algorithms or different key material for those two planes that are layered on top of each other. One interesting question is in this context, and I haven't really experimented with that yet. If you do voice over Wi-Fi, what kind of key material is used for the EPDG IPsec, for the outer IPsec tunnel? I guess it's going to be the USIM one, but I'm not 100% sure on that. And then inside that, you have the PCSCF with the ISIM application. This is just a diagram from the spec about the files that exist in the ISIM in a tree representation. I'm going to go through them quickly. So we have the IMPI that may contain IMS private user identities. We have the IMPU, which may contain public user identities. Those are identities used in IMS registration. A domain name, likewise, also relevant for IMS registration. EFAD, actually, I don't know what exactly it contains in the ISIM. In the USIM, I would know it. Access rule reference is, as usual, is defines the basically the, well, the permissions and access control lists for the files. The ISIM service table is like the USIM service table in the USIM, so it's a long bit mask of bits defining which optional features this card implements or doesn't implement. And then we have the PCSCF address and generic bootstrapping architecture parameters. The NAF key center address. Does anyone know what that is about? I didn't know until today when I read this in the context of this presentation.
It's XCAP, isn't it?
Not that I'm my understanding, and it was just very quickly reading, is this is really about a optional new mechanism that I never saw, how the communication between the SIM and the phone could be encrypted, so that SIMTrace, for example, wouldn't show you anything anymore. There is a spec about that. That was my, as it, I haven't really seen this in practice and I haven't investigated it further. Then we have SMS related files optionally. I don't think many will put them there in the IMS application because most cards will have a legacy USIM anyway, and then you have those files there. Couple of other configurations, XCAP config data, that is basically supplementary services for IMS, IMS configuration, and even in WebRTC URI that you can put there. I don't know how this is used. And some multiple user identity. I also don't know what about this. This is really 16 stuff. I don't know exactly what this is for, this MUTMID config data. If anyone knows, I would be happy to be enlightened about that. It's for Apple Watches. Okay, well, something I know, another topic I know nothing about. Good. So for the recording, the comment was it's the MUTMID is for Apple Watches, etc., and it's about getting calls on a second device. Yeah, these new files, particularly the last ones here in the list, they bring us to a topic that I already briefly mentioned. That's called the BRTLV or BearTLV files, which is a new type, a new structure of files on the cards, which is different from the traditional transparent, linear, fixed, or cyclic files. How is it different? Well, it stores data in BearTLV format, and what a surprise if it's called that way. So basic encoding rules in tag length value, basic encoding rules data. Everyone working in smart cards will have seen this before. But why a different file type? I mean, you can just put the TLV, BER encoded TLV objects in a normal transparent file or even in a linear fixed file. There's nothing that prevents you from doing that. And in fact, I think even some files do that for decades. Well, the difference is that in a BR, in a file that is of BRTLV structure, you can selectively read, write, update basically the object for a single tag as a APDU level operation. So you can say, I want to get the tag 0x74, I want the object represented by that tag, and then the smart card itself will basically look for this tag in the TLV encoded file and will only return this specific tag. One of the advantages compared to putting this in a transparent file is that you don't need to bother with padding, because the on-card file system is aware of the TLV structure and knows how long the record, the TLV object, is. So you don't need to do all this FF padding or strip the FF padding like it was with transparent files when storing such data in them. These files are, for those who are using the SysMo iSIM cards, are supported from SysMo iSIM SJA 2 version 2 onwards. We don't really publicly mention version 2 anywhere. It means the IMSI ends in something that's bigger than 50,000 at the end. That is when we introduce this support. There's a number of BRTLV files in later 3GPP specs that may exist. I mean, they're all not mandatory, of course. It's a lot of stuff that I think nobody uses, like these graphics files or multimedia messages. I'd never heard before, well, outside of the specs, that anyone stores MMS messages on SIM cards. Mission critical services that may be in those mission critical public emergency services and so on, I don't know, may very well be deployed. V2X is a vehicle to something, so automotive use of 4G, 5G configuration. And then we have the IMS and the MATMIT config data, which are BRTLV files. I was really surprised to see that they add, like, rather new, I think it was what, release 14 or something. I wouldn't put my, I wouldn't bet on that, but it was rather late in the standardization process, that rather recent, that they introduced these BRTLV files. I was rather surprised, because I cannot really think of any other reason other than the smart card vendors want to sell more new smart cards or new operating systems for which they can charge more compared to the older ones. So, of course, if you have a smart card in the field for 10 years and it's produced long before these BRTLV structure files are, no over-the-air mechanism is going to help you add this new file type to your operating system. So you actually need in most situations, you need a new card at this point if you want to use one of those files. So yeah, a bit strange, but well, many things I think are strange in terms of SIM card specs. Okay, good. So yes, BRTLV as such, PROM notes that it has been around in ISO 7816 for quite some time. Are you referring specifically to BRTLV structured files or just to the BRTLV? Of course, in the SIM cards everywhere you have BRTLV, like your file control parameters are BRTLV encoded, and many of the even transparent files are specified to do that. But having this file type with the structure of BRTLV, that in 3GPP context is rather recent, introducing that. Okay, good. Then I probably forgot about it, or the ISO 7816 I remember reading 20 years ago was too old to have this in there. So the 5G dedicated file is the next topic. So for 5G, unlike for IMS, 3GPP did not specify a new card application, so there's no 5G ADF, no application dedicated file, no related application. The same USIM is used as for 4G and previously for 3G. There are some new optional additional files in a new dedicated file underneath ADF USIM. So we have ADF USIM, and below that we have DF5GS. And then we have various files. And of course, all of those files have new services in the USIM service table that indicate whether or not those files are present. We have the 3GPP Loki file that is like EF Loki and EPS Loki. So it contains the location area, location information, which is the service area code, tracking area code, whatever, of the last cell when the UE shuts down, so that when it reboots, it can restart scanning for exactly this cell, assuming that it was not moved in geography between switching off and switching on. We have the NAS security context authentication keys. Again, the 5G auth keys file is like EF.keys in 3G, or even the same EF keys for 2G before. So the current session keys that are stored on the SIM card, so that after reboot of the phone, or even switching it off for some time, switching it on later, we still have the keys that were last generated during authentication mechanism. The SUCHI computation in the mobile equipment, we will get to that in a separate slide. Operator list, of course, we have operator lists for all the other technologies. So now we can have an operator list for 5G. We can have SUPI as network access identifier in cases where there is no IMSI. So in 5G networks, there's no longer a requirement to have an IMSI as a unique identifier. I mean, but other identifiers and those other form of identifier can be stored in this EF SUPI NAI. Some other additional configuration options there in other files. This is again the tree representation of that. Sorry for this thumbnails in there that was unintentional when taking the screenshot. Just a few files, very few compared to all the hundreds of existing files for older technologies. And one topic that relates to SIM cards in 5G is the topic of calculating the SUCHI. So the SUCHI is the subscriber concealed identifier, unlike the SUPI, the subscriber permanent identifier. And the SUCHI is a concealed version of this permanent identifier. So the SUPI, in legacy cases, the IMSI is a unique identifier for the subscriber. And of course, for privacy reasons, this is always bad if you have a unique identifier being transmitted over the radio network in terms of tracking people and location privacy and so on. And if the SUCHI mechanism is being used, then the IMSI or the SUPI is not transmitted in clear text anymore over the radio interface. And the question now is, how is this concealment computation or operation, where is it happening? And there's two scenarios or two options. One is that the SUCHI is computed on the phone, on the mobile equipment, using key material that it has obtained from the SIM card by reading it from the SIM. Or the other option, the more secure one, of course, is the SUCHI computation on the SIM card itself, meaning that there's like in the, let's say in the UMTS AKA, for example, there's secret key material stored on the SIM card, and it's not visible to the file system. It's not readable to an outside entity of the card. But the SIM card computes basically using the SUPI and this key material, it computes the concealed identifier and passes it to the mobile equipment, to the phone, to use over the network. In terms of like normal SIM cards that I can buy from operators, and also in terms of SIM card OSs that I'm aware of, the vast majority doesn't support the computation on SIM card. I've only seen it in the EU ICC universe in terms of eSIM profiles, but not in classic SIM cards. Haven't seen it there yet, but of course it will happen eventually, I'm quite sure. It's just a matter of until everybody updates to later CardOS versions and so on. And now, in terms of the card, in the USIM service table, which we don't see here since it's the USIM service table and there's no 5G specific service table, you configure whether which of those two, well, if the SUPI is used at all, and if then which of those two methods are being used. If it's the computation on the phone, then you have the SUPI calc info file, which basically contains the relevant information so that the UE can perform the calculation. Okay, that's it for the 5G SIM card related topics. Any questions on that particular topic before we move to the next? Didn't see any so far. Okay. Yeah, so Merlin has just shared a tutorial for writing the SUPI calc info to the card. That's appreciated. Could of course also merge that in the PySIM shell user manual if you did it with PySIM shell. If you wanted to integrate it there, of course, I think many people would. I would expect it's more likely that people would find it there in the context of PySIM at least, which of course is not the only way of doing things. Okay, then let's get to the RRM and Android carrier privileges. So as the name implies, this is an Android specific topic. It doesn't have any implications on non-Android devices, but on Android, it's possible using the system to give certain applications more access to more APIs on the Android operating system. So we're not talking about card applications here, but about Android apps. And the amount of APIs an Android app gets access to can be increased by this mechanism. And what kind of APIs are we talking about? It's about the carrier operator related settings like APN roaming lists, IMS configuration parameters, also some other things which I find more curious, like you can inject SMSs into Android from an app, basically SMSs that were not received over the radio, but like not over the normal like signaling, but some app that you run on the phone receives an SMS over some IP mechanism and then can inject it into Android as if it was received from the radio network. I'm not sure, probably people do this to avoid, like maybe MVNOs do this to avoid SMS charges, I have no idea. But it's one of the more strange things that you can do once an app has these carrier privileges. Now, how do you get into that like elevated privilege level? There is a hash or certificate of the key used, like all the Android apps are signed with a key anyway. And if you put a hash of the signature key on the SIM in a specific way, then Android matches this and detects it, and the API access is granted to such applications. Unfortunately, it's not as easy as putting this in a file in the file system, but they had to do something convoluted called secure element access control for this. This is a slide from the specifications of this, the global platform secure access control, secure element access control specification. Yes. So we have basically the device, which is the phone in this context. Then we have the access control enforcer, which is whatever part of the Android operating system that enforces access to those APIs. We have the application which with signature certificate. And then we have a communication to the SIM card. And the secure element is the SIM card in this context. And one part in the issuer security domain of the card is this so-called RRM applet. And now the access control enforcer talks to the RRM applet and gets these hashes of the certificate, basically. And it can then detect whether an application should receive this elevated privilege level for the API or not. This is fully publicly documented. Like, the RRM applet and this access control mechanism is a global platform spec, and then the Android-specific bits of this are documented in the AOSP project from Android. So that's all public. There's nothing secret about it. So how can you play with this in practice? Well, either you have a SIM card that has this RRM built in or pre-installed in some form from the SIM card vendor, or if your card doesn't do that, but it is a Java card, then there is an open source minimal implementation of an RRM applet from Bertrand Martel. Yeah, you can download that. It's Java source code. You can compile it and you can flash it, install it on your Java card using global platform, by the way, which we will get to later in this talk. We installed this already on the Sysmo ISIM SJA2 cards. So if you have one of these, the exact open source RRM applet here is already pre-installed on the cards. And in recent months also, we have PySIM shell support for this. So we can more comfortably install and delete rules there. Supreet Harley has written a lot of information about this topic in his CUIMS wiki, so you can read more about this mechanism there. In terms of PySIM shell updates, compared to almost a year ago, 10 months ago by now, when the last talk, or the first and last talk about PySIM shell happened here in the Osmo Dev Call, we have, of course, lots of bug fixes, a number of new commands, new encoders, decoders, and so on. In terms of the commands, the TS102222 administrative commands are supported, as I mentioned before. There is a new UST service check command. It's basically, I always think of it sort of an FSCK, a file system check for the SIM card. It tests for consistency, whether the services enabled in the service table correspond to the files that are available and selectable on the card, because there's usually some relationship, unfortunately not always one-to-one, but sometimes end-to-end relationships, whether this service is enabled, then this and that and this other file should exist, or vice versa. This can be tested. I can demo this quickly after we go through the slides. We have the APDU command, which allows you to enter or to execute arbitrary APDUs as hex string from PySIM shell. Well, of course, you can do that with PyScriptor or with CyberFlex shell or any other tool. But the advantages from doing this inside PySIM shell is that you can use all the other commands for navigation in the file system, for example, the high-level commands, and verifying the ADM pin, which you've already stored in your CSV file, so you don't need to manually enter it, and all these comfortable bits. And then you can enter a raw APDU just to do something that is not possible with PySIM shell yet at the given location. The export, which exports all the files of the card, has a --- JSON option, so it doesn't only export in the binary hex dump, but also in the decoded JSON format. That's of course not that's more for reading the export for human interpretation, or maybe programmatic access to the card content in decoded form. But the normal classic export is for backup and restore of SIM cards. And there, of course, it's good to store the raw hex data because then you know for sure that it will be restored exactly the same way and you don't have any encoders and decoders in there. Yeah, TLV definitions, encoders, decoders, BRTLV file support, RRM applet support, and in general support for non-Sysmocom cards was added and improved. It's of course not as tested, but yeah. I'm working right now on some basic global platform stuff, which we will get to in a second, but I think I quickly show what can be done with PySIM shell these days. So, well, let's increase the font size a bit, probably even. Does that work? Or is it too small for the screen share? Works fine on 2K, works well. Okay, good. So, yeah. We started PySIM shell, we're in the master file. We see already the USIM ISIM application is present. We also see there's an issue security domain and we see the RRM applet with its application ID is found. So let's look at the some of the things, the UST service check, for example. So I can go, by the way, traditionally, you always had to select every element of the path. Now we can also select aggregate paths. So I can do something like that, EF UST. And now I can do the UST service check, which goes through all the services. And you see on this card, there's a lot of things that shouldn't, that are not correct as they should. So let's start from top. So basically, we iterate over all the services in the USIM service table, and we see, well, service number 2 is active. And if this number service is active, the spec says this file EFFDN URI should be selectable. It should not be selectable, but it is. So we find that this file can be selected despite the spec saying if service number 2 is active, this file shouldn't be selectable. And basically, all these consistencies are checked, and you can then use, for example, the administrative commands to deactivate the file to fulfill the condition. And we can actually do that as an example now. I mean, just look through the list. There's more stuff that is not how it should be. Also, the inverse here, we have services active, but the related files are not selectable, even though they should be. Basically tells you 55 service file inconsistencies detected in this card, and you can now go on fixing those up. So if we have service 2, let's just see what this is all about, the service 2. Service 2 is, this is too long, is fixed dialing numbers apparently, yeah. And the complaint was that FDN URI is selectable, but it should not be selectable. Okay, so we can select the EF.FDN URI. It is selectable, we can confirm that. But apparently it should not be selectable. So if it should not be selectable, we can deactivate it. I can verify the ADM pin, which I've stored in the CSV file, so I don't need to remember it. The CSV file looks it up based on the ICC ID. And it displays it because that's the best security practice ever to display the administrator pin on the screen. And now we can, for example, deactivate the file. And if we now again select the USIM service table and we again perform the UST service check, then hopefully there will not be an error about service number 2 anymore. Indeed, it just says checking service number 2 active, okay, but no error message. And indeed, we now only have 53 inconsistencies rather than 55 that we had before. So we've seen the administrative command. And if I would select now the FDN URI again, I get, of course, selected file invalidated. This file can no longer be selected. So I see that the deactivate has actually happened. And if I want to activate the file again, I can say activate file, of course, from the DF in which the from the ADF USIM, basically. I cannot select the file, right? I need to activate it first, and now if I select it again, I can again select the file. So we have seen administrative commands. We've seen the UST service check commands that we have. The APDU command, well, don't really have a nice APDU now that we could do. Where we could whatever 00A400004023F00 that selects the master file for those who cannot read APDUX code in their head. So we have selected 3F00, which is the master file, and that's exactly the kind of thing you shouldn't do with the APDU command, because as the command description says, dangerous, PySim shell will not know any card state changes and not continue to work as expected, for example, if you select a different file, right? Because now we have, the card has changed the selected file, but the PySim shell still thinks we are in this file, and thereby we have inconsistency. So that's not what it is meant to do, but I didn't really have any other idea about what APDU to use it right now in this demonstration. So let's just do a select MF here and bring those two states in sync again. We have the export -json, so maybe very quickly, let's do an export in the old-fashioned way and abort it quickly. So we see it selects certain files like this EFADN and DF Telecom. What's new is that we also get the raw in a comment, the raw FCP template and the decoded FCP template, which tells us with file size and all kinds of things. But the individual records are all displayed or saved in hex. The point of this is that you can use this generated export to restore the card content, because these commands here can be basically used as a script or a standard into PySim shell. But we now have this new JSON mode. Where we can see now lots of JSON that gets dumped here. Basically, all the individual records that we are reading are now decoded by the decoders we have for those files, and we get a decoded representation of those files in the export, which is nice if you basically just want to get a full, like, readable dump of the card in a text file. You can redirect that. It takes some time, of course, if you let it continue all the way to the end. But then you have basically something you can grab through and search and so on. Okay, then we have more encoders, decoders. That's difficult to show exactly which were added, and it's too detailed. The VRTLV file support has been added, so we can do select ADF ISIM, for example, select EF IMS config data. Ah, it's invalidated. Activate file. So this is a VRTLV file, which we... not on this card. This is a broken card. So as you can see here, the structure of this file is transparent, but it should be a BRTLV file. So this is a card that does not support BRTLV files. Bad preparation. I should have had a card ready. In any case, if we look at help, we will see there's the BRTLV related commands. So we have delete data, retrieve tags, and set data. And those are the commands that we could now use if it actually was a correct card with BRTLV structured files in this case. So RRM support, select. ADF.RRM. Now we're in the RRM application dedicated file. It has been selected. And if I again type help here, we see application specific commands. And for example, we can do RRM get all, and we get a JSON decoded representation of the access rule reference data object stored in this RR applet for And actually that part I think is the must be the certificate hash for the application that should then get permissions on Android in this example. And you can use the other commands, of course, to store rules, to delete rules, and all of that. It's documented in the manual, the details, and support for generic cards, of course, yes, and some. That's something that I'm working on, maybe very quickly before we go into the global platform discussion. So sometimes you have a hex string that you want to decode, which is not from a card. Like you have some kind of protocol trace or something, and you know this is a record of a file on the card, a certain file on the card, and it would be nice to use all the decoders that we now have in PySim Shell on this hex string. Let me just very quickly get such a hex string that is not from this card. Also, if, for example, you work with eSIM profiles and you have these ASN1 text, ASN1 value notation files for an eSIM profile, likewise there, you may have a hex string that represents some record or some file, and you would like to run it through the PySIM decoder. Just give me a second. Let's say we want something like no, that's not a good idea. Let's take the EFIMSI, for example. So I've copy and pasted now from some text file the hex string that represents the IMSI somewhere on another card. And now what I can do is I can say select pdfusim/EFIMSI. So I go into that file and then I say hex decode hex, I think it is decode hex, and copy and paste that string. And then it runs it through the decoder as if that data was coming from the card, and gives you the decoded representation of that IMSI in this example. So that's another usability improvement for this. And the very early beginnings of global platform, but that we will look at after talking about global platform. How are we in terms of time? I have the feeling it's already going on way too long. Okay, global platform. So, global platform is what specifies the Java card universe. SIM cards are not required to be Java cards, of course, but in practice they mostly are. And mostly only implement older global platform versions. One of the interesting topics, which is my main, my main vector for this now, is how to install, remove, lock, and unlock applets on the card. And in order to do so, we need these transport layer security protocols, at least one of them, in order to access those features of global platform. Specifically, what I want to add in PySim Shell as a most important feature is the ability to lock applets. How is that useful? There's quite a number of users of the Sysmo iSIM cards which want to deactivate the iSIM applet, or even want to deactivate the USIM and the iSIM applet in a way that the card behaves like a classic 2G SIM card, for example. And the way how we suggest to do this so far is to remove the records from the EFDIR, from the directory of applications on the card. But there's a number of phones that just don't care what is in EFDIR and select the applet and basically try blind selection of the applet. And if it is there, it will use it no matter whether it's in the directory or not. And that is possible through locking an applet, this option of really like we can deactivate a file or activate a file, and similarly we can lock or unlock applets, but we need a global platform to do this since it's not a file system operation. So Global Platform has a number of APU level commands. For example, for key management, you can put and delete keys. Likewise, you can store some data or remove data. And so on. Then there's an entire litany of commands for installation and deletion of executable and applets, all these different install versions. I'm not going to read through them. I always found that rather funny. I always read this in the spec, but yeah, they have so many different variants of install. I'm sure it makes it sense. So, but what we need to do in order to use most of those commands, I think I mentioned it somewhere. No, I didn't. What we need to do is we need to establish a transport level security between our external software and the card. To do those global platform operations, it's not sufficient to have an ADM pin, like for those administrative commands that Etsy specifies. We just need the ADM pin and a properly configured card, and we can do that. But for global platform, we need a secure communication channel. And that means we need to implement the necessary transport protocol for that. And the protocol that is used by the majority of the SIM cards I know is SCP-02, not SCP-03. That's the later. SCP-01 is already deprecated for many years. It's the older version. And I think it's Secure Channel Protocol, the SCP acronym. And not to be confused with Secure Copy, which I just realized. So what it does is it performs mutual authentication between the card and the external software using a separate set of keys that's not related to any of the SIM card keys, not related to K, OPC, and so on. And from this mutual authentication, it generates session keys. And then using those session keys, you can have message authentication and or encryption of the data, and you can exchange these protected APDUs between on-card and off-card software. So the process looks a bit like this. So the off-card entity, which is our software in this case on the PC or on a phone, which hypothetically might use that, but I don't think there's phones really doing global platform SCP-02 to cards. That would mean that the phone itself would have the key material to access that. So there's an initialize update command. I don't know why they have such a strange name for establishing a secure channel. There's a host challenge generated with a random factor, this initialize update. Then the security domain on the card itself will basically generate session keys and a card challenge using a random factor, respond with that in the initialize update response. The software entity here on the off-card entity will verify the cryptogram that has been received and respond with the cryptogram in the external authenticate command. And once this process has successfully completed, we have session keys and mutual authentication and can exchange secure messages between both sides. So yeah, these are the commands related to SCP-02. We have initialize, update, external authenticate. Those two we will discuss shortly later. Once we have the keys, there is the CMAC, the command message authentication code, which basically, you have the APDU in plain text that you want to send, class, instruction, P1, P2, length of command, and optional data here. And to this data field, you add padding, the padding up to whatever size that your Mac will generate here at the end, your CMAC algorithm. You increase the length, of the command by the size of the padding here. Also, you set some secure messaging bit in the class byte in the front of the APDU. By the way, this shows the so-called modified APDU CMAC. There's two flavors, and the card will tell you which of the flavors it supports. In my case, I'm working with cards that use the modified APDU scheme, which means you change the LC and set the secure messaging bit before you compute the MAC. Whereas in the other scheme, you first compute the MAC and then you change those bits afterwards. So you have the padding, then you generate the MAC. ICV, I think, is also a result of the mutual authentication, the session keys. And then you copy basically those fields and append the MAC, and then you have your authenticated APDU that you can send to the card. Likewise, there's optional response MAC that you can enable, which means that the responses from the card to the software, off-card software, will have a message authentication code. And let's not look at all the details here. And then last but not least, you can also enable data field encryption, which means that after you computed the MAC, you basically remove the MAC again. Then you add some padding to the data, you encrypt the data, and then you append the MAC again. So the authentication code is done only on the plain text like you want it. And you have the encryption that doesn't already include the MAC field. Yeah, that's correct. It's data field. Prom just says that RMAC and RANC are rare with SCP-02. And the header bytes are like a class instruction, and also I think the parameter bytes and the length even is all not encrypted. That's all plain text. That's why it's called data field encryption. Only the data field is encrypted. So we still know what kind of instructions are being executed, and of course, well, probably like what kind of parameters. But the data that is in the command is encrypted in this mechanism, if it's enabled. Yeah. So this is all the theory. So what about the practice? I did some research and looking for implementations of SCP-02. I mean, what probably most people use is Global Platform Pro, of course, which is a Java program that can be used and implements like all of this and much more. But of course, I would like to implement some support in PySim shell, so we can also, for example, lock applets, delete applets, unlock applets, all these operations. And there's two implementations of SCP-02 in Python. One of them is, I think it's called Asterix, not Asterisk like the PBX, but Asterix. Like the comic character. And the other one, I forgot the name. The problem is, Asterix looks rather nice and complete, has API documentation, seems to have a nice data model, really nice, but it's Python 2. And Python 2 in the kind of flavor that takes tons of manual effort to convert to Python 3. It's not just running 2 to 3. And then there's the other implementation, which is a Python 3 implementation, but it's, an acquired taste in terms of the programming style, because it seems to prefer using only methods without any object orientation and using only global variables instead of having arguments or functions. So and no documentation, of course. So that's also not really a suitable Python library to use. So I think in the end, one will have to come up with a new library. Maybe inheriting some ideas from Asterix, since as I said, from a high level, it looked rather nice. It's just that it's a Python 2 implementation, which hurts these days. Of course, it was written some years ago when that all made sense. Yeah, so I don't have a schedule or a plan. It's just on my wish list. And of course, there's always many projects on my wish list. But I guess 1 year from now, we will have for sure have it at some point. In the meantime, I guess we will have some library. Yeah. Last but not least, one slide about over the air. And since we're already running way beyond the schedule, Maybe we will have a separate talk about that at some point in the future. So over the air is a mechanism how the some software element in an operator core network or behind an operator core network can talk to a SIM card in the field. It traverses the entire 3GPP core and radio access network, hence the name over the air. So in this system overview from the relevant ETSI spec, actually, is that we have some kind of sending application and a receiving application. So one could be in an UICC and one could be off a site. So in this case, let's say the UICC is on this side. So the receiving entity is your phone and you have an application on the SIM card and you have a transport mechanism in between. And a transport mechanism could be SMS point-to-point or SMS cell broadcast or a USSD or a TCP-based mechanism. So there's a variety of different transport mechanisms how a secure tunnel can be established between something on the operator backend and the SIM card, and then applications on the SIM card can exchange these OTA APDUs to perform basically anything that the card wants. But the most common operations that we have implemented on cards is the remote application management called RAM and remote file management called RFM. And using remote file management, you can update files, create files, deactivate files, all the stuff that you would do with an ADM pin in front of the card if you have it on your desk. And with remote application management, you can basically do what you can also do with global platform in terms of like installing applets and things like that. And with that, I finally stopped my lengthy monologue. Sorry for taking so long, probably a couple of too many topics squeezed in one talk, and I will shut up now.
Yes, I think it's good to hear an in-depth treatment of this. I mean, all of this global platform and smart card stuff can be a bit confusing. It shares the property with the telephony standards. All of these standards are layered. A lot of them are kind of grab bags of features. Like, for example, ISO 7816 has a lot of options, like BRTLV, for example, that many smart card standards don't use at all. And some of them have only found use over time, like, for example, BRTLV in ISIM. Also, these standards often have a lot of concepts that are meant only for specific use. So you kind of have to know which parts of the standards to ignore in a specific use case if you want to be somewhat pragmatic about it. I've mentioned in the chat that my project has an implementation of a global platform host site in Java that, of course, includes the SCPs. I have relatively complete implementations of them that have tests against some vectors and so on. I currently don't have a project to drive me porting this to Python, but I did want to do this because it's easier to tool with, easier to, you know, get to people with, quite honestly, who likes Java after all. But I'll be glad to discuss options for moving on here. And if anyone has questions about global platform, I think I should be able to answer most of them.
Yeah, thanks for that. Let's see if somebody has questions. There's plenty of people who like Java. I mean, maybe not you and me, but undoubtedly there's plenty of people who like it. So,
I mean, in my project, I do have very idiomatic Java implementations of all of this. None of this is really pretty, but I mean, it works if you're consistent with it. My reason for going Java was that I was doing things mostly around development tooling. And for that, it was easier to do this in Java because it's the best and easiest way to integrate with all of the Java side tooling.
Yeah, I mean, Java is extremely strong in the smart card context, undoubtedly. So it's an obvious choice in terms of the existing universe, let's say. One nice bit about Python, I'm not sure, I mean, Thorben probably knows, but I'm not sure how many others. The PySCard framework has a very nice, I think they call it SmartCard Connection Decorator class, which allows you to basically have a shim layer that does the encryption and decryption. So all your higher level code that, for example, selects a file or reads a binary or does whatever, you can basically just plug this, you implement a derived class of this smart card decorator that implements your encryption, decryption, MAC, whatever. And then you can use the same code that you had before basically on top of that.
Yes, that sounds very nice because wrapping these protocols, it's all quite a mess internally. I've found it well, at least. I mean, I had to think about it for a while when I implemented this and how to do this in a secure way, kind of isolating the right aspects. The standards don't really point out how to do that. You have to figure all of that out on your own.